from the Sky News Centre at 6. Boris Johnson says Theresa May's current plan for Brexit would be a disaster for the UK if Brussels did end up agreeing to it. The former Foreign Secretary's revealed his vision, suggesting a Canada-style free trade agreement instead. He previously described her Chequers proposal as a suicide vest wrapped around Britain and faced criticism for comparing women who wear burqas to letterboxes. Our reporter Beth Rigby asked him if it was prime ministerial language.
That's for others to judge.
I stand by what I say.
The father of a girl who died after eating a Pret a Manger baguette claims the law was playing Russian roulette with his daughter's life. The 15-year-old died from a severe allergic reaction, but Pret wasn't required to warn about sesame seeds. Police searching for a missing student from Worcester have found a body in the River Severn. 18-year-old Thomas Jones disappeared more than a week ago. Houses have been flattened and footage shows people running away screaming in fear as a tsunami hit an island in Indonesia. A quake with a magnitude of 7.5 struck off Sulawesi. That's the latest. I'm Tanya Snuggs.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins, Labour member and author and former PR for the Glastonbury Festival, Mal Sainsbury. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, a recap of seven new pieces of evidence from Arnhem about the sabotage of the battle by British traitors in the Allied High Command and the subsequent Bilderberg meetings in Oosterbeek, which is just in the outskirts of Arnhem where the battle took place, as well as details on the battle's legacy from Rob van der Zon, who was born in the Witch's Cauldron where this battle happened in September 1944. Also from Hebron, we hear from Issa Amro, who was due to be speaking at the Labour Party conference this week, but was stopped from leaving the country by Israel's Shin Bet intelligence service because he appeared in a BBC programme, at least this is the reason they gave, with Jews over in Hebron discussing Israeli apartheid in his town. So he's not allowed to leave the country. Plus, Bellingcat hits the news again, identifying one of the two Salisbury tourists as a top Russian intelligence colonel. But who is Bellingcat, and why does what he says gets reported first and only checked and found out to be speculation by the BBC afterwards? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, the 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius, pretty chilly, isn't it? Now, with a moderate breeze, but dry. This weekend, temperatures highs of around 16 Celsius, sunnier tomorrow, but cloudier on Sunday. So forget the shopping, just go out and enjoy yourself tomorrow. Light winds and throughout the weekend. Next week is highs of 18 Celsius, mainly cloudy with some sunny spells and also breezy. Also next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of October, highs of 14 Celsius, wet and windy with a few sunny spells. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com as the winter creeps towards us. So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins, and also Labour Party member and author Mal Sainsbury. Hi, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
I think I'll talk to you first, Mal. Author, always interested if people have actually managed to find the time to write a book that's worth printing and somebody says, gosh, we'd like to publish that. So what have you been up to?
Well, because I was a copywriter for many years, so we're talking about formula writing here.
as opposed to creative writing. So one of my books was actually translated into 12 languages and went to 42 countries. But I'm afraid it hasn't made me rich beyond the dreams of avarice. It was educational stuff.
So when you're copywriting, explain what that means.
Copywriting is when you write the slogans for things, or you
advertising.
Advertising, that kind of thing, yes.
So which, did you work for one of the big advertisers, or were you working for yourself?
We used to work quite closely with advertising agencies. Did a lot of stuff for Orange at the time, who of course used to, when they stepped in to sponsor Glastonbury, that's when everything changed.
What changed when they stepped in?
Well, really, I think when the big corporates start stepping into things like festivals, it gets very big, and it starts to become, from my point of view, I loved being at Glastonbury doing the press, and I was there for 12 years, but as soon as the big corporates started stepping in, it became not Planet Glastonbury, where all extraordinary things could happen. It became more manufactured. So where I was dealing with the press and the world's press, they were being sort of presented with something that was manufactured rather than something magical that was happening. So that was my goodbye.
So you were there for how long? And just tell us the difference between how it all worked when you arrived and when you finally decided, I've had enough of this.
I worked there for about 12 years and loved it. And I will not hear a word said against the marvellous Michael Evers and how he started that. But it got too big. I think all the smaller festivals, they aspire to be the most popular, and then what happens, they get tangled up with health and safety and insurance and, you know, the gate thing and I always said with Glastonbury that as soon as you got to the point where the only people that were at Glastonbury were the ones that could afford a ticket, that was probably the time that you wouldn't get the diversity.
The policing is also a big thing,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, huge thing.
And it's also been used over the years to close festivals down. Like, I can remember I used to enjoy going to the Big Green Gathering up on the Mendips until there was Colin Port and Avon and Somerset Police pulled the plug at the last minute on that festival. It wasn't the biggest festival, but it was a lot of fun. So what do you think about Glastonbury now? Is it something that you'd advise the youngsters to go along to? Because it seems to have sort of changed from the original. And if not, can you recommend a couple of festivals, other festivals, that you think are a bit more in the old-fashioned Glastonbury spirit?
When Shambhala started, that was wonderful. That got rather big as well, wasn't it? I think the smaller the festival, I think the Elephant Fair is still beautiful, isn't it? It still has that wonderful old-fashioned feeling to it. What did you ask me first of all? There was a specific question
about the festival.
The policing when it changes. Well, we had Ashton Court Free Festival, which was the very first free festival and the largest in Europe. And we actually created the children's area because, you know, the festival goes, we're getting older and they're having kids and stuff. And it was just a really joyous, wonderful thing to do. And then I think we had to look back on that at the time and say, wasn't it wonderful to have that for 13 years? Because, of course, that eventually closed down. And that was to do with insurance and bad weather and policing.
Yeah, maybe we can bring Gary in here. It's the idea of a free festival seems to be almost out now. I mean, there are a few around, but what do you make of what happened with Ashton Court? It was a bit of a special thing that Bristol used to do every year.
Well, I think that councils and the police forces, etc., get nervous when things don't seem to be controlled. Unfortunately, at the moment, the council's on its drive to try and make everything pay them a lot of money, which is not very good. I mean, Ashton Court recently had the most ludicrous sight of the present mayor trying to bully the little miniature railway out of existence, which is absolutely appalling. They're occupied.
Surely, I mean, hang on, Gary, because if it's not paying for itself, he's got every right to say, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to either deliver a profit or go.
Well, in actual fact, it was paying for itself. They were invited in a lot of years ago. They paid their rent as required. They take up a little corner of Ashton Court. They've invested tens of thousands of pounds in a lovely facility. Lots of kids, lots of underprivileged kids love it. It costs practically nothing, and it contributes to this city. And basically trying to throw them off when they've got no other use for the land at all at the moment, haven't worked out what they're going to do with it. And actually, they do contribute a little bit, and people go along and use the car park, pay a couple of pounds, etc. So it works, you know? But I'm afraid because they don't control it, they don't like it.
Well, the other thing that seems to happen quite often when the council's closed various facilities that they've had for years and years down is that it then just goes onto the slate and then it just gets flogged off. It's like selling off the family silver.
Well, I'm afraid that sometimes economies are very false. Bean counters, you know, and there's quite a lot of them around, very often don't have the imagination to realise that something that appears free actually can make you quite a lot of money if you use it properly, if you encourage it and the right sort of spin-offs that come from it.
There's a real hot potato parks at the moment. You know, the so-called consultation about how do we make parks pay for themselves, you know, advertising, or do we charge dog walkers?
Hire them out to farmers to graze their sheep.
Well, that would be better than what's being proposed.
Well, actually, we did have a plan for putting cattle back onto Stoke Park for a while, and actually that would be popular. A lot of local people said, yeah, we want them back, and it would make a few pounds as well, so yes, that's fine.
But what, when the cows get in the way of the football, if you're playing football, if cows wandering across the
there were no football pitches there, but I'm afraid Slasher and her mates have just, you know, they're ruining the parks. There's some great people involved with parks in Bristol, because I used to run them a few years ago. They've got great imagination, they know how to do it, and they've put in loads of sensible ideas, but I'm afraid they're not being listened to.
But when you were running the parks, Gary, famously, you were trying to flog the corners of them all off, weren't you?
No.
Yes, you were.
No.
All right, well, give us your version then.
Right, what actually happened was the Parks Forums, which was the group of all the parks enthusiasts around the city, they were spoken to and said, well, look, you know, we do need to improve the financial position a bit. And what they said was, we need more money spent on parks to improve the quality. Great, okay. So where do we get the money from? And their suggestion was some of the less used green land, less popular, some of that could be sold and the money reinvested in the parks and ring-fenced. And that's the plan. Not one park was ever put up for sale. In fact, we actually increased the amount of parks that we had in the city by taking on Stoke Park from a private owner. So, no, not one park was sold.
But these little bits
never of, one was proposed
these
for sale.
Little bits of green, though, are the green lungs of the city. And you were seen at the time as the man that wants to flog them off to the highest bidder.
Well, you know, don't believe everything you read in the Evening Post. But basically, I'll give an example of one place in Bristol where it did actually happen, in my ward, because I had the guts to see through the right way to do it. And we had a very large field which had been used for football in the past but wasn't, and we split that up. A third of it has gone for social housing. And that's much needed, and that's what we did with it. And we got a lot of money for that, for selling that off for social housing, a third of it. A third of it went to a school playing field. 700 children in a primary school who had no school playing field, because a lot of those have been sold off in the past. And I can tell you the headmaster was amazed that we're actually getting one added where all the other school playing fields are sold off. And the other third of it is being made into a proper park with proper investment, so that people who live in the area, there's a playground, there's some landscaping, etc. So what was a large chunk of grass that, quite frankly, wasn't used for anything practical, is now a park, a school playing field, and social housing. And I'm proud of that.
Well, okay, but anyway, so...
That's what the scheme is all about, the Parks and Green Spaces strategy. And you speak to the real parks enthusiasts, and they'll tell you what it's about. And if you look at their website, there's a list on there of 20 reasons why the Parks and Green Spaces strategy is the best way forward.
Anyway, we were due to have Hibak Jama, councillor, Labour councillor, on here this evening, and she booked in around about 2.5-3 months ago with me, but she cancelled it without saying anything. So when I phoned her yesterday, she said, oh, sorry, I found something else to do, I'm not coming. But that's the second time she's done that. So she's got the kind of Marvin syndrome of he wants to book on and then eventually he decides he doesn't want to do it. So, but it actually ends up being, I think, counterproductive, because it means that we can't just ask them the basic questions we need to our local councillors. Now, this isn't the only thing that's going on, Gary, is it? Because we've also got the withdrawing of information about future business for the Cabinet. Now, the Cabinet, it runs the city.
Yes.
It's Marvin's hand-picked little group that makes all the big decisions about how our £350 million a year gets spent. But we're finding out less and less all the time, in fact, only with a few days' notice now, about what there actually is on their agenda. So it's almost, I would imagine, impossible to do any research or scrutinise what they're up to if you don't know what they're planning on them, what they're going to even be discussing until a few days before they do it. So what's going on with the future business here?
Well, I'm afraid that the Mayor does not like people questioning anything that he does. And it was very noticeable that a couple of months before this really got up to the worst level that it is now, that the Overview and Scrutiny Management Board, ACLEI, which was councillors from all four parties, had a series of meetings over a week, and we managed to get a fair amount of information on the arena, on the alternative plans. And we were actually able to cross-examine the Malaysian company, we cross-examined officers, we cross-examined the operators' plan for Temple Meads, and basically after that, it was a very, very clear decision. 10 out of 11 of us, and that's from all four parties, said the arena must proceed at Temple Meads and gave a whole list of reasons why. After that, Marvin just stopped any information getting out at all.
What I want to know is, I mean, how disempowering is it to have this mayor at this level? Because it appears to me that he can overturn any democratic councillor-led decisions.
Yes, he can. And the basic system of the mayor is fundamentally and absolutely wrong. It means that, one person on a whim can change everything without any information. We warned that putting all this power into one person's pair of hands is completely wrong. But, you know, the Tories actually wanted it at the time. They campaigned for it, and some Labour members went along with it. And the media at the time thought it was a good idea, and it went through.
Well, one thing
basically
about
now, we're going to abolish it.
One thing about the arena that fascinates me in a sort of slightly perverse way is that the guy that's fronting it is this chap called Colin Skellett. He's a sort of local businessman. His dad was a postman, I think, and he's made a lot of money. He's also become the chairman of Wessex Water, and the company YTL that owns Wessex Water is the same company that's doing the plans for this Filton version of the arena. But I looked him up, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page. About 10 years ago, he was arrested by the City of London Police for £1 million bribe, apparently, that he was supposed to have taken. It turned out, apparently, that he hadn't taken £1 million bribe, but this £1 million has just arrived, or nearly £1 million, had arrived in his bank account from YTL when he managed to fix the deal to get YTL to buy Wessex Water, because it was one of those companies that was owned by Enron. When Enron collapsed, YTL bought it, and £1 million nearly arrived in Colin Skellett's bank account. So Colin wasn't actually taking a bribe. What was actually happening there was he was getting a forward payment over for many years into the future for some money that the YTL people had decided to pay him. But it does seem a bit bizarre, Gary, that this is the guy that's fronting this Filton Arena. Do you think it'll ever happen?
I really don't know what the real reason for going out there is, because Marvin wanted to cancel the arena at Temple Meads. He didn't want that to proceed. Before he could do that, he made up his mind to do this almost 2 years ago. Before he could do that, he had to have an alibi. So the invented arena at Filton was it. So that it could look like, oh,
do you think
it's
like
a
some sort of phantom arena?
Well, it might happen, it might not, I don't know. But the point is that YTL are putting in a massive housing estate up there. They want somebody to put transport links into it. We'll invent an arena so that we can get huge amounts of public money spent on transport links to enhance the value of our land up here. That's what the original cause is. Whether the arena ever gets built, I don't know. If it does, what it'll actually do is take a lot of business out of Bristol city centre and push it up to Filton and Cribbs Causeway, which would be a disaster for the centre of Bristol.
Mal, it does sound to me a little bit like your Labour mayor here is more in with the corporate people, almost like a Conservative would be, rather than with the ordinary people in the city, who've made it quite clear they want this arena at Temple Meads because it's so much more accessible there.
I'd like to know who's advising Marvin, actually. I mean, he seems to have an open ear for certain, you know, members of his particular circle. And, of course, the power closes around. And is it in the best interest? I mean, a lot of people say to me when I'm campaigning on doors, they actually say to me, well, look at the situation here in Bristol, and we're supposed to have a Labour council, you know, far away from these corporate concerns, lubricating the pockets of whoever is going to give permission for them, not saying anything libelous there, I hope, but at the same time, we have some urgent concerns here in Bristol that should be addressed by a Labour councillor.
Okay, so what do you think that Marvin's major priorities should be?
Homelessness is my big bugbear. We now have over 100 street homeless people in Bristol. There's something very odd going on with the council's idea of how we deal with this, how we liaise commission the services of hostels, for instance, to actually provide and meet the needs of people who have such issues that they need great support. It's not just a question of actually finding homes for people, it's about supporting people.
Well, why do you say odd?
I think it's very odd because there's a very punitive approach. We have something called Streetwise, which is part of council, and we find that they seem to spend an awful lot of our money serving injunctions on homeless people who have nothing, who are struggling to claim universal credit, that, you know, Compass workers are supposed to be advising people how to do this, and then they're serving injunctions on them and criminalising homeless people. We have in the civil courts here and the magistrates, we have judges saying, surely this is a matter for police. Why are you, I mean, it costs something like 250 odd pounds to serve an injunction, and I know one young homeless woman, for instance, who's been served 27 of these. You know, I mean, for goodness sake, can we just start addressing some
basic
things?
Okay, so these would be injunctions to stay away from a particular area, for not to do certain something? Is that
It's dredging up things like ASBOs and things like saying...
The Vagrancy Act as well.
Yes, the Vagrancy Act. And also, because Bristol City Council, I think they've... You could correct me on this, Gary, but I think they took a grant of 180 grand from Immigration Control, who worked alongside Streetwise. And so, therefore, what you would find is that people, working people that just didn't have anywhere to live, that didn't have the right papers, were then shipped straight out and deported. And this was absolutely scandalous because, you know, this is not exactly helping in people who actually urgently need assistance with finding homes.
And actually, it's not just a box for them to live in. I mean, I've had discussions with Jasper Thompson from Help Bristol Homeless, and basically his approach is very different to the council's. And actually was commenting to me about this hugely expensive hostel that they're going to put in at St Anne's. But the design is all wrong. Basically, the first thing that people want is safety, and they haven't thought that through. That, you know, but as well as actually having a box to live in, they need some self-respect and to be able to feel that they're contributing back. So that's the way that he does it.
Are very dangerous places for people to be.
Yes.
People with issues. If you stick people into a 6 or 8 bed dormitory sort of room, for which the council is charged 350 or whatever quid a week, and you're not allowed in it till 10 at night and kicked out at 7 in the morning, one young homeless person I knew, you're very at risk of being assaulted and having your things stolen. And he said to me, once again all my things were stolen, and once again nobody was there to notice.
But surely, Mal, I mean, the more money you're going to throw at the homeless situation, it's not going to actually help, is it? Because the whole situation for an individual is all you could do is the sort of bare minimum, and then potentially maybe a little bit, maybe, so a roof over their head is basically all they need, but you could spend an almost infinite amount in trying to look after people.
You actually need support. I mean, if people have all sorts kinds of issues, now that research shows very, very clearly that, you know, traumatic childhood experiences lead on to addictive behaviours, we have lots of problems with alcohol and drugs, and we have people who are in urgent need of having issues addressed, and the staff don't seem to be up to it, because what's happening now is that more and more people are becoming more and more in urgent need, and it's not throwing money is a problem. You need to actually use the money in a different way, in a supportive way.
So what is the council actually doing, Gary?
It's making a mess. It's spending a lot of money but not achieving much. Having spoken to Jasper about this, really, and having seen the way that they actually run things, which is small scale but it works, and basically the people that they are helping are very soon turning around and being the helpers themselves, because they're involved in actually delivering something and helping towards something, rather than just being shoved in a corner and told, you know, we've looked after you, haven't we? Well, no, they haven't. And a lot of the people that are out in the street have got very complex needs, as you said. Quite a lot of them are actually ex-forces. The people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorders.
Martin Summers, these two have been chatting for a while. I haven't really brought you in yet. But this is, I mean, it's a nutty conundrum, the whole homelessness thing. Paul Smith has decided, who does the housing for the council, they're going to start building council houses, start building affordable houses actually by the city council. Of course, that takes years and years. And it won't even be the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the, well, we heard from Mal 100. I've heard from Paul Smith when I interviewed him, he said there could be up to 400 people a night sleeping out, and we've got the winter coming on now.
Well, there's loads of other people who are homeless who aren't sleeping on the streets, you know, they're sofa surfing or what have you. It's a massive problem, and people are in work not able to pay the rent. But if you remember, we had an NGO we interviewed some years ago, Tony, that recommended to the Welsh government that if they and this is happening in other parts of the world, I believe, in Canada and the US, where they say housing first. People have got multiple issues. That's accepted. But you don't solve anything unless you provide them with, first of all, somewhere to go. And the, in actual fact, if I think the NGO was, I've forgotten the name of it, they were arguing.
This was Crisis, actually.
Yeah,
Crisis.
But what they were saying is when people are about to become homeless, you should intervene to prevent that at all costs. Because then if you keep them in their houses, they can then deal with whatever the problems they've got. And of course, universal credit has this ridiculous, now 5 week, it was 6 week gap where you can't claim any money at all. And of course, the old system of housing benefit was, the idea is if people have had a difficult problem, they've been made redundant or whatever, you want them to keep their housing so that they can then resolve what the problem is. But of course, universal credit, because of Ian Duncan Smith's, you know, basically punitive attitude, people just go straight into rent arrears straight away. And of course, they lose their housing, which is why homelessness, measured homelessness, has increased everywhere where universal credit has been introduced, and it's still the case, and it's just bad policy. They could easily make it go back to the old system of just paying people the rent.
Well, I'll tell you what Paul Smith was saying, is that they don't have the money to do it for all of the street homeless people. Well, they, much as they'd like to, they just don't have the cash. Where do you get the cash from? Well, the guy to ask this week at the Labour Party conference was John McDonnell. He's the Shadow Chancellor. So let's have a listen to a little bit of his speech now at the Labour conference in Liverpool.
J.K. Galbraith, in his book on the 29 crash, said, sure, you can try and create institutions that seek to avoid crashes in the future, but the best protection is memory. So it's worth remembering the causes of the crash. They were greed, yes, and the deregulation that turned the city into a multi-billion pound casino. But more importantly, it was caused by the power that a small financial elite exercises over our political system. That power meant the bankers and speculators who caused the crisis wouldn't be the ones who paid for it. It would be our families, working people, our businesses, our young, and especially the most vulnerable in our society. And it's been 8 hard years of austerity and economic failure. In the 6th richest country in the world, it cannot be right that 5,000 of our fellow citizens are sleeping on the streets. It cannot be right. It can't be right. 4 million of our children are living in poverty. 2/3 of them are in households where someone is in work. That tells you that wages are so low, below the levels of 2010. The wages not sufficient to provide a decent standard of life for many of our people. The Tories have created an age of insecurity where people have little, if any, control or power over their lives. So it's no wonder that so many people voted for Brexit. It was an anti-establishment vote. So I believe it's time. It's time. It's time to shift the balance of power in this country. It's time to give people back control over their lives. You know, there's another anniversary this year. It's 100 years ago, in 1918, the Labour Party adopted Clause 4 as part of our party's constitution.
And he'll explain in a minute what Clause 4 was, I hope.
Let me remind you what it said. to secure for the workers, by hand or brain, the full fruits of their industry. I say the Clause 4 principles are as relevant today as they were back then. It is fair, democratic, collective solutions to the challenges of our modern economy. You know, the Labour movement has always believed that democracy shouldn't stop when we clock on at the factory gate or in the office lobby or, like my mum, behind the BHS counter. Democracy is at the heart of our socialism, and extending it should always be our goal. Our predecessors fought for democracy in Parliament against the divine right of kings and the aristocracy. They fought for working people to get the franchise. Our sisters fought for women's suffrage in the teeth of ferocious opposition. And our movement fought for workers to have a voice at work. And the trade unions. The trade unions founded this party to take that democratic vision even further. So in 2018, I tell you that at the heart of our programme is the greatest extension of economic democratic rights that this country has ever seen. And it starts in the workplace. It's undeniable now that the balance of power at work has been tipped against the worker. The result is long hours, low productivity, low pay, and the insecurity of 0 hours contracts. I want to thank the IPPR for its recent report. It was a brilliant critique of the inequality embedded in today's economy. Archbishop Welby took some stick in the media and some in the establishment for his support for the report. He wasn't engaging in party politics. He was simply speaking the truth as a moral leader in our society. Just a few words of advice for the Archbishop. Archbishop, when they get round to calling you a Marxist, I'll give you some tips on how to handle it, OK?
So that's the Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell speaking at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool earlier this week. Gary Hopkins, he's citing there your austerity programme that the Lib Dems did.
Not my austerity programme at all.
The Lib Dems did with the Conservatives back in 2010 in the coalition government.
No.
5,000 street homeless is the result. 4 million children in poverty, and two-thirds of those kids are in households where there's people are working in those households. So do you think that was a mistake, austerity?
No, I think that what actually happened was that there was a desperate state of the economy in 2008, and actually cuts in terms of some of the things that started in 2008, not 2010, as some people like to say. There was a need for a strong government and some rebalancing of the finances, which were in a terrible mess. And we worked on that, and we kept things to a large extent under control from the Tories. Over the last 2 or 3 years, it's been an absolute mayhem. Everything that's gone disastrously wrong with the economy has happened since we left the government. And I'm afraid that over the last couple of years, it's been Tories red in tooth and claw, and they've been absolutely appalling. We actually made quite a lot of progress in terms of redistribution of where taxes came from and that sort of thing, and in terms of some benefits. Not everything was perfect. We didn't like some of it, you know. A lot of it we didn't like doing. But bluntly, it was a job that had to be done. Now, I absolutely accept that Nick Clegg made an absolute berk of himself, and actually the Rose Garden is the most embarrassing thing I've ever seen in my life. But that didn't mean to say that the working together didn't need to happen, because it did. The country was in a mess.
Martin Summers, what do you make of John McDonnell's speech there, really talking about, and also include what he makes of Clause 4? He didn't say it there, but it's one of the main things there is about nationalisation, isn't it?
All right, well, let's just deal with the coalition government first of all. The country lost its AAA credit rating when George Osborne was the Chancellor, and when Vince Cable also sold off the post office for a fraction of its real value. And of course, they lost the country's AAA credit rating because they said they were going to reduce the deficit to zero in one parliamentary term. They tried to do it. They couldn't do it. The economy started going down the drain, so they took their foot off the brake. And of course, it then started to pick up again. But they lost the country's AAA credit rating at that point. And as I said to Nick Clegg just after he'd been elected, you're going to lose the country's AAA credit rating for this radio station. And he just didn't understand the question. And the fact is that they didn't understand the basic macroeconomics. Now let's come to John McDonald.
And clause four.
Let's come to John McDonald. The idea that the people like Nick Clegg and George Osborne are economically competent is simply wrong. What happened when I was taught economics in the 1970s? We were taught that these kinds of ways of looking at the economy were old-fashioned, stupid. And we basically laughed at them in the economics department. And then, blow me down, along come these people who are, Osborne had a 2-1 in modern history. He's got no economics background at all. Okay? And that's why they messed up, because they don't understand basic macroeconomics.
It's a wonderful idea of clause 4 of nationalising things. Where are Labour going to get the money to do that?
Well, the fact is, when you want to nationalise something, don't forget that the East Coast Main Line, Virgin took it over, and they've actually been let off the money that they owed because they put the wrong bid in. And in actual fact, many of these things actually don't make a profit as long as you regulate them properly. Like the water industry, if it's properly regulated, it wouldn't be profitable. And of course, therefore, you've got to build in a profit for the people you've sold it to. And as you rightly pointed out, what used to be Bristol Water ended up as part of Enron, which was part of a huge scam in the United States of America.
That was Wessex Water.
Wessex Water. But I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it? That should have been a locally run thing for people providing water locally here. And instead, it's part of a huge scam based in California. And of course, when it goes down the drain, like Carillion's gone down the drain, the state has to pick up the tab.
YTL, as far as I know, is in Malaysia, not California. But anyhow, Mel, what do you make of what he's saying there? I just think the potential, a lot of people listening will think, well, he's talking about spending all this money and doing all these public services again, nationalising things, but they're out of money, basically. How is he going to square the circle?
I remind everyone that, in fact, the Labour Party were the only people that actually had a fully funded and costed manifesto. And in actual fact, it makes sense. I mean, this conference has actually strengthens everyone's feeling. And I think it's tapped into the zeitgeist that for the last 10 years, the capitalist approach has not been working. We are in greater deficit and greater debt than we were. The idea that somehow the Lib Dems put a little bit of a curb on the Tories and actually stopped things being as bad as they would be, they were completely and absolutely, they betrayed all the young people that voted for them. When I think about the students wearing those T-shirts with the words on the back saying, "This is where Nick Clegg stabbed me," I mean, that was the end of that, you know. I mean, there was no credibility left for those people. But they were still, you know, in Bristol, let's get back to local things again. In the Bristol Labour Council, it's still ideologically driven. What the council are doing is throwing money in an ideological fashion to get people to take on extra jobs, to somehow work longer hours, because there's a certain new team now working that were taken on to actually target all the people because of bedroom tax, because of benefit caps, because of universal credit that's now been introduced. There's now in council housing in Bristol, and probably Gary can tell me exactly the numbers, but there's between 30 and 40% of people are in debt, working or not. And so the new team in the council, which is targeting those people at risk of losing their homes, is not talking about, let's have a look at, you know, how we're dealing with things here and how we're actually using the money. And it is a huge budget. Let's look at targeting these poor people who are very worried about losing their homes so that they can get extra qualifications, take on more work. This is absolutely ludicrous. It's ideologically driven. There's still the whispers here of the coalition backing up very, very bad policy indeed.
Well, in actual fact, it's not a new team. Things went into abeyance when we had the previous mayor. But no, those teams that help and to assist people to get into better paid jobs, to get themselves away from debt, have been there for a very long time. It's just that now we're hearing that it's a new solution. It's same with the house building.
You say that a very long time, but they were very sort of inactive. I mean, the little tiny bits of stuff that they were doing before has now come to a crisis because between 30% and 40% of people, council house tenants, isn't, are at risk of losing.
I mean, just hang on a second, folks, because isn't the real problem that the jobs are simply not paying enough, and that there aren't enough of them? If there were more jobs, and if they were paying enough, then there wouldn't be all these problems with people paying rent, and also there would be enough tax coming in and enough benefits to pay for disabled people. And
for the working poor, it's disgraceful. In the old days, if you had regulated rents and this kind of thing that is being promised if we have a change of government, you wouldn't expect to pay more than a third of your income, whatever that income was.
But
now, people, working people, are paying 80 to 90% on these unregulated private rents. There are over 12 million private renters in this country, and the situation is getting worse and worse. We have a housing crisis on that is not going to be solved by throwing money at
situations. Before we come on to the wonderful issue of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, let you have the final word on this housing and charity.
I picked up a Labour leaflet, which is a rarity in my ward, in any event, talking about the wonderful revolution they're actually having in reducing the number of empty council houses, and who are building so many more. So I checked back with the council officers for all the figures, and in actual fact there was a house building plummeted under the previous mayor, but the present administration are not building yet even 50% of the number of houses that we built when we were in power in Bristol. So that's the factual position.
What people are so angry about are the empty properties left to rack and ruin, and for every single homeless unit, that could be a single person or a family, there are 10 empty properties in this country. We need to look at refurbishment, we need to look at relaxing all those things that have been holding us back, and we need to look at housing the homeless.
In terms of actual empty properties in Bristol, the number's actually quite small, and administrations of all colours have worked quite well on that over a long period of time, and there are measures which are actually reducing that number.
I think, maybe this is, if I can have the final word actually, is that the rise in population has actually been abused by the financial planners to just fuel a property bubble. That's what it seems to me. Anyway, on anti-Semitism, let's have a listen to... Because Margaret Hodge, who was at the centre of this anti-Semitism scandal, who accused Jeremy Corbyn of being anti-Semite and a bleep-bleep racist, she's a Labour MP, got a really, I thought, scathing attack, which I quite actually enjoyed, because it points out some of the flaws in her argument about Jeremy Corbyn actually being some sort of Jew hater. And so I thought we'd have a listen to Norman Finkelstein, who had some interesting things to say. He's a Jewish author of a book called The Holocaust Industry. Fascinating, controversial Jewish guy. But here is what he had to say about Labour's Margaret Hodge. And we'll hear everyone's views on the Labour anti-Semitism scandal after we've heard from Norman.
My mother used to talk about how she walked the streets of the ghetto and there were dead bodies all around her. She lost both of her parents, all of her family, her sisters, her brother. They were deported. But unlike you, Dame Hodge, they weren't deported to a summer home. They were deported to a death camp. My parents ended up in Auschwitz and Majdanek and slave labor camps. Where are you going, Ms. Hodge? To Switzerland? To your chalet? And you have the gall, the brass, the audacity to compare your life with what my parents endured? You felt it was like 1930s. When you got a letter from the disciplinary committee. I wonder, Dame Hodge, when you were in sixth grade and your principal called you down to his office, did it bring back memories of the Holocaust? Or maybe you got a letter from the tax office and they called you down. Did that remind you of the Holocaust? What's the pertinence of dragging in the suffering, the death, the martyrdom of what Jews endured during World War II in this context, except to cheapen and exploit the memory of Jewish suffering as you carry on a blackmail and extortion racket against Jeremy Corbyn. It's disgusting. It's revolting. And if any of the rules that are now being implemented in the Labour Party have any meaning whatsoever, the first person who should be booted out of the Labour Party is Dame Hodge for trivializing the memory of the Nazi Holocaust and for making wretched, repulsive comparisons between herself and what Jews endured during World War II.
So that's Norman Finkelstein. He's author of The Holocaust Industry and various other books. Jewish guy. Martin Summers, what do you make of his rant, really, I suppose you could call that, against Margaret Hodge there? He's saying that her comparisons between Jeremy Corbyn and the anti-Semites are simply appalling.
Well, Finkelstein, although you might not guess it from that, is actually an academic. He's a professor. Well, I think quite a lot of left-wing Jews like him are really, really offended by this. They're getting very upset because, of course, if you're going to have anti-Semitism as a serious allegation, which it should be, it shouldn't just be used as the chiff-chaff of general political rowing. Yeah, and of course, at one stage, the media picked up on Jeremy Corbyn's speaking at a meeting where somebody had compared the Israeli government to the Nazis. Now, the person of whose name I've forgotten who compared the Israeli government to the Nazis was himself an inmate of Auschwitz, and he'd come through it, and and of course in Israel itself it's quite common for politicians to accuse each other of being like the Nazis.
Well, I was reading a letter the other day by Albert Einstein in the 1940s, yep, to the New York Times, where he was comparing the new Israeli government to the Nazis even at that early stage. So yep, apparently that's now, even Albert Einstein is an anti-Semite.
Yeah, well, just to finish up, we know because of the Al Jazeera sting that was carried out on the Israeli embassy about a year and a half ago that £1 million was put aside for steering the Labour Party in the direction that the Israeli embassy wanted it to go. And we saw that on Al Jazeera. It's gone all the way around the world. We know that that's what's been going on. And the Jewish Labour movement get lots of freebies to go to Israel all the time. And, Dame Margaret Hodge is, very much in
the United States, Martin.
In cahoots with those people.
In the United States, AIPAC, the Israel lobby, is an incredibly powerful organisation. In fact, it's involved in the selection of many of the senators and congressmen and women. Do you think that a similar organisation is
Absolutely.
As powerful here in Britain?
Well, it's hard to say whether it's as powerful. It's very powerful. There's no doubt about it. They have a great deal of influence. And, of course, the money that the Israelis spend to get the influence isn't really their money, because the whole Israeli state is basically propped up on US tax dollars. So US taxpayers' money is then funneled into Britain to try and steer. And £1 million to spend in the Labour Party, that's a lot. We don't have a lot of money. They've got £1 million to spend to get what they want, and we know that that's what's happening, because they were caught red-handed doing it.
Okay, anyway, Mal, what do you make of this row going on in the Labour Party?
Exactly, disgraceful, the weaponisation of anti-Semitism. And did you guys see, it was about a week or so ago, the Speaker in the House, there was a debate going on, and in fact she asked for people to declare interest, and suddenly all the people within that little compadre of people that support that, they all had to stand up and say things like, well, I had a wonderful trip to Israel a couple of weeks ago, yes, that was all paid for, and all the rest of it. So basically it's all been politicised to the extent that it's unbelievable. I mean, the idea that in an organisation, I say an organisation, the Labour Party has over 500,000 members, that like anything else with numbers, you would have a small tiny minority of people that are racist, that are anti-Semitist, and it must be stamped out. But the idea that proportionately it's actually much more than any other party is simply ridiculous.
My own experience is the only real anti-Semites, people who are blaming the Jews for the world's problems, I've only ever come across them within the Conservative Party, personally. But anyway, Gary, what do you make of this row going on in the Labour Party?
Well, it's a mixture, isn't it? There's some very unwise comments have come from some people within the Labour Party. But then again, on the opposite side, you've got a lot of Islamophobia amongst the Conservatives. And basically, they're both reprehensible. And I'm afraid that it was bad management from the leadership of the Labour Party that they didn't manage to stamp on it when, yes, it's not everyone in the Labour Party is anti-Semitic. We know that, but the problem has been allowed to get out of control by allowing some people to get away with saying stupid things and not stamping on it.
Well, would you agree with what Margaret Hodges said? I mean, comparing Jeremy Corbyn to saying that he's a Jew hater, a racist, that sort of thing, and swearing at him?
Well, I think that sometimes political discourse gets out of control on both sides, doesn't it? And basically, but I did listen with more interest to what Sachs had to say when he was interviewed on a Sunday, and he's a very thoughtful sort of chap. And his comments were quite frightening as well, in terms of the way that a lot of Jewish people actually feel about what's happening.
I mean, there are all sorts of different groups that say they represent the Jewish community, Mal. I mean, I'm not sure, do they?
Well, the thing is, if you have a look at Jewish Voice for Labour, which sprang up in actual fact to defend Labour against these ridiculous accusations of a disproportionate amount of anti-Semitism, and in actual fact, what was Jeremy Corbyn accused of? Fraternising with the wrong kind of Jews. I mean, what a load of nonsense that was. I think, in actual fact, it's now, because of the conference, and that's thankfully gone much more into the background, because it was a complete red herring.
Well, what was also interesting at the conference is the vote that a Labour government would recognise Palestine and also cut off arms to Israel. Yeah. Overwhelmingly passed.
Yes.
And that's what this is really all about. Palestine. Yes.
Okay, we'll be hearing a bit more about... In fact, we'll be hearing from Hebron. This is the chap from Hebron who was supposed to be speaking at the Labour Party conference but was denied the right to leave Israel, to go to Jordan to catch a flight to London. But we'll be hearing from him in the second half. But anyway, let's now hear from the Labour leader himself, Jeremy Corbyn, for an excerpt from his speech where he talks about... Well, I suppose you just sum it up by talking about social justice.
It is only through the unity of all our people that we can deliver social justice for anyone. Conference, change in our country is long overdue. Every month this government remains in office, things get worse. Evidence of the failure of privatisation and outsourcing is piling up day after day. What's long been a scam is now a crisis. Just look at the last few months. The Birmingham prison, run by G4S, had to be brought back into public ownership after the chief inspector of prisons described it as the worst he'd ever visited. The privatised probation service on the brink of meltdown. Richard Bergen, the next Secretary of State for Justice, will end this scandal. On the railways, the East Coast franchise has collapsed for the third time in a decade, bailed out yet again by the taxpayers. Do you know what? You get on a train at King's Cross and you never know who'll be running the train by the time you get to Edinburgh. Andy MacDonald, our Transport Secretary, will end this shambles and bring about a serious, sensible transport policy. And the giant privateer Carillion has gone bankrupt, sunk in a sea of reckless greed, leaving hospitals half-built, workers dumped on the dole, pensions in peril, while the Carillion directors continued to stuff their pockets with bonuses and dividends, and small businesses in the supply chain took heavy losses or went bust. And speaking of bankruptcy, the Tories are now extending it into their own backyard. A Conservative government and Conservative local councillors have combined to push Northamptonshire over the edge, putting vital services to those who need and rely on them at risk. 8 years of destructive austerity and obsessive outsourcing have left Either council's teetering on the precipice too, and this government must be held to account for their social vandalism they're carrying out across the country. It is Labour councils and only Labour councils that are taking every step to protect people and services. And we must thank them for it. Thank those councillors for the work they do, day in and day out.
Huge scandals in some of the privatisations. Huge scandals there have been in plenty of other places where publicly managed organisations have made a desperate mess as well. In both cases, the reason it happens is because of secrecy and stuff swept underneath the carpet, which is exactly what this Labour council in Bristol is doing at this moment.
But Jeremy Corbyn there is saying that actually it's only the Labour councillors who are pushing back against central government to try and make sure that services can be restored or even just kept going.
Oh, really? Yes. This is the Labour council that illegally, and it was found in the court, illegally cut £5 million from SEN budgets and hid it from people, that had to send money back to government.
Sorry, special educational needs.
Yes, special educational needs. And were found to be, completely contemptuous of the needs of the children. £5 million. It was found afterwards, as soon as it became public, yes, the money could be found. This is the same administration that's actually had to send money back that was there for the people premium for looked after children because they couldn't organise themselves to spend it, so it had to be sent back to central government the year after. That's what this administration is doing. It's paying £1,450 a day to an officer of this council that's actually not gone through proper procedures for being recruited and is actually was plotting for a year and a half in secret to kill off the arena. That's what this council
is doing. I think the voice of power in this so-called, and I'm doing inverted commas here, Labour council, must have Lib Dem in its DNA somewhere. I'm sure it is.
Martin Summers, what do you make of Jeremy?
Well, I think the criticisms about how Bristol City Council's managing its affairs, I take that. I'm not a councillor. I'm prepared to listen to things on their merits. But I think there's a wider question about what the balance between the public and the private sector should be in our society. And of course, in actual fact, the majority of opinion polls have shown for many years that most people want actually a national, the basic utilities to be nationalised.
Jeremy talked about Carillion there. It's almost been forgotten, hasn't it, that this massive so-called private public sector organisation totally dropped the ball with a cost of billions of pounds to us.
Well, the other thing that nobody's been talking about is the bailout of the banks by the new Labour government at the end during the financial crisis, and that's fundamental to everything. That's where we had quantitative easing for 10 years. It was supposed to be running for a few months while the banks got their books sorted out, and of course we're still doing it 10 years later. We've got the biggest bubble in history, which is going to burst, and of course that will be a big problem for any government, Labour or anything else.
I'll leave the final word to Mao about this, because at the end of the day, we do need to have a serious look at where the money's coming from to actually restore our services. Do you think Jeremy's up to that? Because he's got MPs against him, hasn't he?
He certainly is up to it, and we're now in a position of great strength.
He's got his own MPs against him.
I know, but in fact, they are melting away into the mediocrity of their middling places where they are still allied to the old New Labour. But in fact, those private trust initiatives, when you think about borrowing £11 billion, and we now have to struggle with interest payments of £80 billion building hospitals. It's a disgrace. It was a disgrace. We need to get all our public utilities back into public ownership.
Time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks very much to our guests. It's Gary Hopkins for Noel, for the Lib Dems, and Mal Sainsbury, who's a Labour Party member and an author. Back after the news.
Mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.